This is the Cambridge English Proficiency Test 2. I am going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you are listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There will now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1.
All of you are graduating with a degree in science. So what is science? Some people say that it's about discovering facts and truths about the natural world. In my own field, which is climate science, it's not uncommon to hear about scientific debates, uncertainties and scepticism. Indeed, repeated questioning and testing of our understanding is a fundamental part of all science. However, this does not mean that every claim about climate change published in a newspaper or on the web is correct. Science is about building up and evaluating the whole body of evidence on a phenomenon. It is based on reproducible observations and experiments. Science is not about selecting a few pieces of data that support an idea and ignoring the rest. Selective misuse of small amounts of data or taking observations out of context to support an agenda is not science. Given this, I'm sure I don't need to tell you the most important thing that you've learned as part of your degree is not the facts that you've learned, but the scientific method, the skills to collect, analyse and evaluate data. Value and build on those skills. All of you are graduating with a degree in science. So what is science? Some people say that it's about discovering facts and truths about the natural world. In my own field, which is climate science, it's not uncommon to hear about scientific debates, uncertainties and scepticism. Indeed, repeated questioning and testing of our understanding is a fundamental part of all science. However, this does not mean that every claim about climate change published in a newspaper or on the web is correct. Science is about building up and evaluating the whole body of evidence on a phenomenon. It is based on reproducible observations and experiments. Science is not about selecting a few pieces of data that support an idea and ignoring the rest. Selective misuse of small amounts of data or taking observations out of context to support an agenda is not science. Given this, I'm sure I don't need to tell you the most important thing that you've learned as part of your degree is not the facts that you've learned, but the scientific method, the skills to collect, analyse and evaluate data. Value and build on those skills.
Extract 2.
Now, today there are a few human beings who, for biological reasons, cannot forget, which sounds like a blessing. They certainly do remember where they parked their car in a shopping mall. But it turns out that they have tremendous difficulties in acting in time, in deciding in time, because they remember all their bad failed decisions in the past, and therefore hesitate to make a decision in the present. Because they're forever tethered to the past, they can't act. They can't stay put in the present, and they can't imagine the future.
So what's the difference between human memory and computer memory or storage?
Computer storage is the capturing of a flow of bits and the retrieval of a flow of bits. It is decontextualized. It is taken out of its original context. We can only guess in what context, in what situation, it was said or done or captured. Human memory, in contrast, is capable of putting things in perspective, of linking events with other events and experiences, of adding context and feeling to it, of reconstructing memory to fit better our own later understanding of what happened. Now, today, there are a few human beings who, for biological reasons, cannot forget, which sounds like a blessing. They certainly do remember where they parked their car in a shopping mall. But it turns out that they have tremendous difficulties in acting in time, in deciding in time, because they remember all their bad, failed decisions in the past, and therefore hesitate to make a decision in the present. Because they're forever tethered to the past, they can't act. They can't stay put in the present, and they can't imagine the future.
So what's the difference between human memory and computer memory or storage?
Computer storage is the capturing of a flow of bits and the retrieval of a flow of bits. It is decontextualized. It is taken out of its original context. We can only guess in what context, in what situation, it was said or done or captured. Human memory, in contrast, is capable of putting things in perspective, of linking events with other events and experiences, of adding context and feeling to it, of reconstructing memory to fit better our own later understanding of what happened.
Extract 3.
Do you think e-books will eventually replace paper ones?
I don't know. There's something about the experience of having a book that's special, isn't there? The feel of it, the cover, all that. You can scribble on it, or even spill your coffee on it, and it's not the end of the world. And if it's well thumbed rather than being pristine, I actually prefer it that way.
Not having to fill up your hand luggage with great heavy tomes when you're getting a flight abroad is a real advantage, though. And you don't have books gathering dust all over the place at home either. But you can't riffle through the pages in the same way with an electronic device.
It's interesting the way technology's trying to replicate some of that experience of books, like turning a page.
I think the really interesting thing is how they'll affect newspapers. Maybe if more people subscribe to read the news online, it'll give the newspaper industry a boost. Or maybe it's really defunct. I mean, even quality papers are having a difficult time of it at the moment. Do you think e-books will eventually replace paper ones?
I don't know. There's something about the experience of having a book that's special, isn't there? The feel of it, the cover, all that. You can scribble on it, or even spill your coffee on it, and it's not the end of the world. And if it's well thumbed rather than being pristine, I actually prefer it that way.
Not having to fill up your hand luggage with great heavy tomes when you're getting a flight abroad is a real advantage, though. And you don't have books gathering dust all over the place at home either. But you can't riffle through the pages in the same way with an electronic device.
It's interesting the way technology's trying to replicate some of that experience of books, like turning a page.
I think the really interesting thing is how they'll affect newspapers. Maybe if more people subscribe to read the news online, it'll give the newspaper industry a boost. Or maybe it's really defunct. I mean, even quality papers are having a difficult time of it at the moment.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a student called Tom giving a presentation about non-native species of animals in Australia and the problems they cause. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
I'm going to talk about some of the new species of animals that have been introduced into Australia and the problems they've caused. Native animals like the kangaroo lived in Australia for millions of years, but when the Europeans came to settle there in the 18th century, they brought new animals with them, and these sometimes had a serious effect on the local ecosystems. One of the introduced species that caused most harm was the rabbit. They were introduced in the 19th century as food and kept in cages, but they soon escaped and took over almost the entire country. The only areas where they're still relatively scarce is where the ground consists of clay, as they like to have soft ground or sand to dig their burrows in. This means they're happy to live in deserts as well as farming land. These rabbits have had a huge impact on native Australian species as they compete with them for food. The rabbits eat the bark from young trees, which kills the trees, and they also consume vast quantities of young plants, destroying them before they can produce the seeds that native birds depend on for their food. One way you can deal with a harmful species such as the rabbit is to find another species that preys on it. But this doesn't always work out. A famous example is the case of the cane toad. This was deliberately introduced into Australia so that it would destroy small beetles that were harming the sugarcane crop. Well, it turned out that the cane toad wasn't particularly good at killing the beetles, but it was highly poisonous to other creatures. It could even be fatal to crocodiles. Because it has no predators, the cane toad has spread widely and become a major pest throughout large parts of Australia, and it's had serious effects on the biodiversity of these regions. Biologists are trying hard to stop the spread of the toads, but so far they've been unsuccessful. One animal that you wouldn't expect to find in Australia is the camel. It's certainly not native to Australia, but in fact it's estimated that there are more than a million camels there. They were first introduced in the 19th century as a way of providing transportation in the sandy deserts of central Australia. They were kept on farms and used for riding, and they also proved invaluable as beasts of burden, supplying necessary goods to the mines way out in the Australian outback. But once other forms of transportation arrived, the camels were released into the wild, where they bred and multiplied, feeding on a wide range of vegetation and having a huge impact on the life cycle of plants. They're particularly attracted by apricot trees and strip the branches in search of the leaves, which means the tree's unable to produce flowers or fruits. As well as affecting the environment, wild camels in Australia may do damage of other sorts. In times of drought, they've been known to come into remote villages in search of water and wreck the pumps there. Many of these communities are very poor, and the damage done by camels in this way can be hard to repair. So, what can be done to prevent invasive species from spreading further in Australia? One solution is to deliberately introduce diseases to wipe out a particular species. This was attempted with rabbits, and it was initially successful, but eventually the rabbits developed resistance to the disease. Attempts to build fences to contain the spread of invasive species can only work on a small scale due to the high cost of building and maintaining them. Shooting or trapping can be used, but the problem's too big for these to be effective methods. In fact, the only place where invasive species have been fully eradicated is an island, and it seems the mainland is just too huge for eradication to be possible, in spite of all the problems this causes the owners of farms there. But the experts haven't given up. The consensus is that broad efforts to control large areas of the country will be useless. Instead, targets have to be limited so that the work's done a little at a time. And of course, the country imposes legislation so that further introduction, deliberate or accidental, of potentially invasive species can be controlled. So perhaps there's hope that in the future the problem will begin to go away.
Now you will hear part two again.
I'm going to talk about some of the new species of animals that have been introduced into Australia and the problems they've caused. Native animals like the kangaroo lived in Australia for millions of years, but when the Europeans came to settle there in the 18th century, they brought new animals with them, and these sometimes had a serious effect on the local ecosystems. One of the introduced species that caused most harm was the rabbit. They were introduced in the 19th century as food and kept in cages, but they soon escaped and took over almost the entire country. The only areas where they're still relatively scarce is where the ground consists of clay, as they like to have soft ground or sand to dig their burrows in. This means they're happy to live in deserts as well as farming land. These rabbits have had a huge impact on native Australian species as they compete with them for food. The rabbits eat the bark from young trees, which kills the trees, and they also consume vast quantities of young plants, destroying them before they can produce the seeds that native birds depend on for their food. One way you can deal with a harmful species such as the rabbit is to find another species that preys on it. But this doesn't always work out. A famous example is the case of the cane toad. This was deliberately introduced into Australia so that it would destroy small beetles that were harming the sugarcane crop. Well, it turned out that the cane toad wasn't particularly good at killing the beetles, but it was highly poisonous to other creatures. It could even be fatal to crocodiles. Because it has no predators, the cane toad has spread widely and become a major pest throughout large parts of Australia, and it's had serious effects on the biodiversity of these regions. Biologists are trying hard to stop the spread of the toads, but so far they've been unsuccessful. One animal that you wouldn't expect to find in Australia is the camel. It's certainly not native to Australia, but in fact it's estimated that there are more than 1 million camels there. They were first introduced in the 19th century as a way of providing transportation in the sandy deserts of central Australia. They were kept on farms and used for riding, and they also proved invaluable as beasts of burden, supplying necessary goods to the mines way out in the Australian outback. But once other forms of transportation arrived, the camels were released into the wild, where they bred and multiplied, feeding on a wide range of vegetation and having a huge impact on the life cycle of plants. They're particularly attracted by apricot trees and strip the branches in search of the leaves, which means the tree's unable to produce flowers or fruits. As well as affecting the environment, wild camels in Australia may do damage of other sorts. In times of drought, they've been known to come into remote villages in search of water and wreck the pumps there. Many of these communities are very poor, and the damage done by camels in this way can be hard to repair. So, what can be done to prevent invasive species from spreading further in Australia? One solution is to deliberately introduce diseases to wipe out a particular species. This was attempted with rabbits, and it was initially successful, but eventually the rabbits developed resistance to the disease. Attempts to build fences to contain the spread of invasive species can only work on a small scale due to the high cost of building and maintaining them. Shooting or trapping can be used, but the problem's too big for these to be effective methods. In fact, the only place where invasive species have been fully eradicated is an island, and it seems the mainland is just too huge for eradication to be possible, in spite of all the problems this causes the owners of farms there. But the experts haven't given up. The consensus is that broad efforts to control large areas of the country will be useless. Instead, targets have to be limited so that the work's done a little at a time. And of course, the country imposes legislation so that further introduction, deliberate or accidental, of potentially invasive species can be controlled. So perhaps there's hope that in the future the problem will begin to go away.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear part of an interview with two British architects, Malcolm Fletcher and Alison Brooks, about the design of new low-cost housing. For questions 16 to 20, Choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
Welcome to today's programme on current issues. Today I'd like to welcome two architects, Malcolm Fletcher and Alison Brooks, who both specialise in domestic architecture. So, starting with you, Alison, what's your reaction to the government's plans to build houses on what in the UK are classified as greenfield sites, sites that are currently in their natural state or used as farmland?
Well, I think it's inevitable, really. There'll be a lot of opposition to it from groups who want to protect the countryside from any development. It's understandable. But Britain is a small, crowded country and you have to be realistic. People need homes, don't they, Malcolm?
Yes. If you take some of our older cities, like Bath or York or Edinburgh, they were built on what were originally greenfield sites, but no one's suggesting that we pull them down. Because people like those buildings. Compared to them, houses that have been built in recent years are unimaginative, to say the least.
So, how can we ever get out of this situation? Break the mould, Malcolm?
There are individual cases where an architect's designed something different and better. For example, there's a small housing development in Essex called Newhall. The key to the innovative design of these houses seems to have been the fact that the people who the land previously belonged to didn't just take as much money as they could and then lose interest. Before they agreed to sell the land, they set conditions which the architect and builders had to meet in order to ensure that the local people would benefit as much as possible from the development.
The commission for the development was actually won by an architect called Margaret Gibbs. I went there recently. There are about 80 houses altogether. They're quite an unusual shape. And they're made of black timber and yellowish-coloured brick. They're quite striking, just because they look different. And I must say that although I like the visual aspect of her design myself, and the reference they make to traditional architecture, they're not everybody's cup of tea.
I think what really distinguishes them from most recent housing developments in this country is that the architect really has paid attention to details which affect the quality of life of the people living in them. And like the way that by using a clever system of timber cassettes, she avoided the need to have timber beams supporting the roof. That means that instead of being wasted, the roof space became available for use. Often young couples have to move to a bigger house when they have children. But in Gibbs's houses, they can use the roof space as an extra bedroom.
But in terms of total area, they're the same as a conventional plot for small houses. But whereas conventional developers build long, thin houses, Gibbs has made hers almost square, so her hall and stairs aren't just narrow strips. She calls them an active social space, which is more central to the plan.
What are the Essex houses like outside? What about the surrounding space?
Well, Margaret Gibbs has given her houses patios and roof decks and porches, but not gardens, so they aren't suitable for horticulturalists. But then not everyone wants to tend the apron of green that you get with conventional new houses. And there are playing fields and other public green spaces nearby anyway.
Yes, and Gibbs says she wanted to make the street itself into an extension of the living space. So the balconies and the studies face the street and people who work from home don't feel isolated. She wanted to change the suburban street from a desolate place into a little working community.
So to round up then, how do Margaret Gibbs's new houses match up to those of Britain's older cities? Are they just as aesthetically pleasing as houses in Bristol or Bath, for example?
They're very different, and they won't please everyone. But I don't think it's helpful to talk about beauty, actually. It's so subjective.
Yes. When people talk about a building being beautiful or stylish, they usually mean that it matches their own personal tastes. So it's not a very useful criterion for assessing architecture. Where we should be going in future, I think, is looking at the extent to which houses enhance people's quality of life and function well.
Right. Well, Malcolm Fletcher and Alison Brooks, thank you.
Now you will hear part three again.
Welcome to today's programme on current issues. Today I'd like to welcome two architects, Malcolm Fletcher and Alison Brooks, who both specialise in domestic architecture. So, starting with you, Alison, what's your reaction to the government's plans to build houses on what in the UK are classified as greenfield sites, sites that are currently in their natural state or used as farmland?
Well, I think it's inevitable, really. There'll be a lot of opposition to it from groups who want to protect the countryside from any development. It's understandable. But Britain is a small, crowded country, and you have to be realistic. People need homes, don't they, Malcolm?
Yes. If you take some of our older cities, like Bath or York or Edinburgh, they were built on what were originally greenfield sites, but no one's suggesting that we pull them down. Because people like those buildings. Compared to them, houses that have been built in recent years are unimaginative, to say the least.
So, how can we ever get out of this situation? Break the mould, Malcolm?
There are individual cases where an architect's designed something different and better. For example, there's a small housing development in Essex called Newhall. The key to the innovative design of these houses seems to have been the fact that the people who the land previously belonged to didn't just take as much money as they could and then lose interest. Before they agreed to sell the land, they set conditions which the architect and builders had to meet in order to ensure that the local people would benefit as much as possible from the development.
The commission for the development was actually won by an architect called Margaret Gibbs. I went there recently. There are about 80 houses altogether. They're quite an unusual shape. And they're made of black timber and yellowish-coloured brick. They're quite striking, just because they look different. And I must say that although I like the visual aspect of her design myself, and the reference they make to traditional architecture, they're not everybody's cup of tea.
I think what really distinguishes them from most recent housing developments in this country is that the architect really has paid attention to details which affect the quality of life of the people living in them. And like the way that by using a clever system of timber cassettes, she avoided the need to have timber beams supporting the roof. That means that instead of being wasted, the roof space became available for use. Often young couples have to move to a bigger house when they have children. But in Gibbs's houses, they can use the roof space as an extra bedroom.
But in terms of total area, they're the same as a conventional plot for small houses. But whereas conventional developers build long, thin houses, Gibbs has made hers almost square, so her hall and stairs aren't just narrow strips. She calls them an active social space, which is more central to the plan.
What are the Essex houses like outside? What about the surrounding space?
Well, Margaret Gibbs has given her houses patios and roof decks and porches, but not gardens, so they aren't suitable for horticulturalists. But then not everyone wants to tend the apron of green that you get with conventional new houses. And there are playing fields and other public green spaces nearby anyway.
Yes, and Gibbs says she wanted to make the street itself into an extension of the living space. So the balconies and the studies face the street and people who work from home don't feel isolated. She wanted to change the suburban street from a desolate place into a little working community.
So to round up then, how do Margaret Gibbs's new houses match up to those of Britain's older cities? Are they just as aesthetically pleasing as houses in Bristol or Bath, for example?
They're very different, and they won't please everyone. But I don't think it's helpful to talk about beauty, actually. It's so subjective.
Yes. When people talk about a building being beautiful or stylish, they usually mean that it matches their own personal tastes. So it's not a very useful criterion for assessing architecture. Where we should be going in future, I think, is looking at the extent to which houses enhance people's quality of life and function well.
Right, well, Malcolm Fletcher and Alison Brooks, thank you.
That is the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four consists of two tasks. You will hear five short extracts in which people talk about academic conferences they have attended. Look at task one. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list, A to H, the reason each speaker gives for wanting to attend an academic conference. Now look at task two. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list, A to H, how each speaker felt about the first presenter. While you listen, you must complete both tasks. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part four. Speaker 1.
I was looking forward to the conference. I'm doing research into kidney function, and while I get on really well with the people in the clinic, and I'm getting some interesting data, there are some knotty areas where I'd really appreciate the chance to exchange ideas with another specialist. I also wanted to get a feel for how these things work before I give my own paper next year. I nearly left after the first presentation, though. That was by Mark Bradley, about developments in kidney transplants. And although the research he described was interesting, I knew the people who'd done it, and I was aware that he misreported some of the results, which was alarming.
Speaker 2.
The first speaker had everyone in stitches from the start, although personally I didn't see the funny side. He was talking about funding for the arts, and you'd expect some sort of argument, wouldn't you? Or at least a position. But all we got was a string of examples and anecdotes. Well told, but that's not the point. Anyway, things got better after that, and I'm glad I went. Having taught 12 weeks without a break and then the summer school, I was ready for some R&R. And when they published the conference details, the combination of the location and the travel grant clinched it for me. Shame my buddies couldn't make it, but never mind.
Speaker 3.
The opening presentation was something else. Repeating his key points could have been quite an effective way for the speaker to get his message across, but I began to feel that either he hadn't had a proper run-through or he didn't know his stuff, and as the umming and ahhing went on, we didn't know where to look. But I wasn't there for that. I had a problem to solve. Over the years, I've written lots of teaching material, and I'd like to see it in print and maybe get a holiday with the proceeds. But I didn't know who to go to, and then I realised there'd be book exhibition stands and representatives at the conference. Problem solved.
Speaker 4.
In academia, I know the only way to get ahead is to get published. Now, I'm not the most focused of people, and I always want to just follow a few more research leads. But a colleague advised me that if I had to write my material up so it was ready to give at a conference, that'd provide me with a clear objective. Well, I managed to do that, and it got accepted. And I really enjoyed the conference. The opening speaker charmed everyone with his light-hearted accounts of his early career as a librarian and the exaggerated claims made for new classification systems. He had a substantial amount of experience, but he didn't labour it.
Speaker 5.
Professionally, I was feeling a little down. Friends told me I needed a vacation, but I had plenty of drive. It was just that for my own sake, I needed to get up to speed with innovations in the field, and I decided attending a conference was a quick fix. Anyway, the opening presenter's methodology and his analytical approach, I could buy. Lots of detail, that all made sense. But his findings didn't all quite hack it for me, and some of the claims he made in his conclusion were a bit dubious as a result. But at least it was original stuff, I suppose, which is more than can be said for some of the papers I heard.
Now you will hear part four again. Speaker one.
I was looking forward to the conference. I'm doing research into kidney function, and while I get on really well with the people in the clinic, and I'm getting some interesting data, there are some knotty areas where I'd really appreciate the chance to exchange ideas with another specialist. I also wanted to get a feel for how these things work before I give my own paper next year. I nearly left after the first presentation, though. That was by Mark Bradley, about developments in kidney transplants. And although the research he described was interesting, I knew the people who'd done it, and I was aware that he misreported some of the results, which was alarming.
Speaker 2.
The first speaker had everyone in stitches from the start, although personally I didn't see the funny side. He was talking about funding for the arts, and you'd expect some sort of argument, wouldn't you? Or at least a position. But all we got was a string of examples and anecdotes. Well told, but that's not the point. Anyway, things got better after that, and I'm glad I went. Having taught 12 weeks without a break and then the summer school, I was ready for some R&R. And when they published the conference details, the combination of the location and the travel grant clinched it for me. Shame my buddies couldn't make it, but never mind.
Speaker 3.
The opening presentation was something else. Repeating his key points could have been quite an effective way for the speaker to get his message across, but I began to feel that either he hadn't had a proper run-through or he didn't know his stuff, and as the umming and ahhing went on, we didn't know where to look. But I wasn't there for that. I had a problem to solve. Over the years, I've written lots of teaching material, and I'd like to see it in print and maybe get a holiday with the proceeds. But I didn't know who to go to, and then I realised there'd be book exhibition stands and representatives at the conference. Problem solved.
Speaker 4.
In academia, I know the only way to get ahead is to get published. Now, I'm not the most focused of people, and I always want to just follow a few more research leads. But a colleague advised me that if I had to write my material up so it was ready to give at a conference, that'd provide me with a clear objective. Well, I managed to do that, and it got accepted. And I really enjoyed the conference. The opening speaker charmed everyone with his light-hearted accounts of his early career as a librarian and the exaggerated claims made for new classification systems. He had a substantial amount of experience, but he didn't labour it.
Speaker 5.
Professionally, I was feeling a little down. Friends told me I needed a vacation, but I had plenty of drive. It was just that for my own sake, I needed to get up to speed with innovations in the field, and I decided attending a conference was a quick fix. Anyway, the opening presenter's methodology and his analytical approach, I could buy. Lots of detail, that all made sense. But his findings didn't all quite hack it for me. And some of the claims he made in his conclusion were a bit dubious as a result. But at least it was original stuff, I suppose, which is more than can be said for some of the papers I heard.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you are sure to finish in time. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.